This is Steve Kraske. This year marks the 20th anniversary of KCUR's Up to Date. 20 years is a long time to host and produce a daily talk show, and our team couldn't do it without KCUR's strong listener support. As a nonprofit news station, KCUR relies on individual donations to make this show. I hope you'll join me in celebrating 20 years of Up to Date by donating today at kcur.org/support. This is Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. I'm Steve Kraske. Today is the International Day of Democracy, so recognized by the UN for the purposes of promoting and upholding the principles of democracy across the globe. KCUR and Up to Date are participating in the nationwide cooperative Democracy Day 2022, a project of the Center for Cooperative Media at Montclair State University. These days, more Americans than maybe ever before are concerned about the state of our democracy. In fact, majorities of Democrats and Republicans in a new Quinnipiac poll said they thought U.S. democracy was on the brink of total collapse. This morning, we'll look at the state of our democracy through the prism of candidates refusing to take part in debates or sit for interviews. We'll look at it through the impact of the once-a-decade redistricting process that both our states just completed, and through the level of access, or the lack of it, that voters have to the ballot box. We begin by looking at how willing candidates are these days to take part in debates, or for that matter, sit down for interviews with reporters. With us, Eli Yokley is a senior reporter at Morning Consult. He covers politics and campaigns. Eli, it's always great to have you here. Welcome back.
Hey, good morning. I wish I was out at Arrowhead tailgating today.
Yeah, all day affair, Eli.
All day.
Bob Beatty is a political science professor and chair of the political science department at Washburn University. Bob, always good to have you as well. Welcome.
It's good to be with you, Steve.
Bob, I want to begin with a question we'll be posing to all our guests today, and that simply is America's democracy in danger? What do you think?
No question about it. It's so sad that we have to ask the question. Mm-hmm. Our topic today is a good one, and actually some of the things that we're going to talk about have been going on for a long time. Actually, I've been in Kansas for 20 years, and so I wanted to be on this program to share my frustrations. But boy, it's gotten so much worse in the last 6 years that it's a little bit scary.
Eli, what's your two cents here?
I think the answer to this is that institutional trust has declined dramatically. It has become a partisan instinct. I mean, you ask trust in the U.S. government. 3 in 10 Republican voters have a lot of trust in the U.S. government today compared to double the amount of Democrats. And so democracy, if whether we believe in democracy is a partisan issue and something that's responsive to who's in charge, then sure, there's definitely a challenge here for us.
We want to ask our audience the same question. Do you think democracy in this country is in danger? You can tweet your answer at KCUR up to date with the hashtag Democracy Day. Well, Bob, this poll from Quinnipiac that came out earlier this month found that fully 67% of those surveyed said that democracy was in danger. That was up 9 points from January. What's driving that? Because that is a significant jump, even when you take in the margin for error. Why the increase?
Well, I agree with that last statement. It's partisanship. And we have to parse that out. You know, we just say a blanket democracy is in danger. We're here talking, we hope, rationally, and you with your guests for the next hour. But in the last few years, we've had a group of people that want to convince others that democracy is in danger, even when it isn't, in order to have a crisis atmosphere and in order to further their political gains. So it's sowing mistrust in a system in order to gain politically or to destroy that system. And that's something that's gone on for 150 years in other countries. And I teach comparative governments, and it's a well-known tactic. And, one of the key things when the subject we're talking about is candidates being available to the media or doing debates, we'll get to, is this ongoing sowing of distrust of the media, which is, basically, if people don't trust the media and the media disappears in a democracy, it's over. I mean, I'm not trying to be too dramatic, but who's watching the store? I mean, that's the key job of the media. And it's amazing to see people who say basically disparage the media and have candidates encourage people to literally beat up members of the media at events.
And Eli, there's been a lot of beating up of the media in recent years. I've lived through that. You have too. What have you experienced in recent months, recent years that make you think that people's distrust of the media has only grown?
Well, it's clearly grown. I mean, I think one issue here is throughout the Trump presidency, this is not the media's fault. It's just the set of events that was in front of them. It was hair on fire for 4 years. I think there was a lot of it was like the alarm was ringing the whole time. And at some point, the Republican electorate, conservatives in this country, independents who just got tired of it, tuned out. And so whenever you see the media as partisan actors, right or wrong, that causes problems. By the way, I mean, we've seen since Joe Biden has taken office, some of this tide come back a little bit in the sense that a number of Democrats, you look at Twitter, you tweet something about Joe Biden, right. That's not great. And people just blow you up. They're like, well, what about Trump? And at some point, we're seeing on both sides of this, to a greater extent on the right, but also on the left, that whenever you're using this, you know, doing accountability journalism or pushing back on something that the administration in charge is doing, you get pushback from their supporters for sure.
You know, this notion, Bob Beatty, that democracy is in danger, is it possible that this could become ultimately a self-fulfilling prophecy here, that because people believe it could happen, that it very well will happen?
That's possible. I believe it's better to talk about it and try to let people know that this is serious business, other than to be surprised, which everybody was, seemed to be, on January 6th. I mean, what we've been seeing is just a crashing of political norms, or what we accept, a political culture will accept as normal behavior, to the point, going to your question, of if you keep breaking down what we thought was not allowed under normal behavior, eventually you can get to something like a coup, or you can get to something like a person in power simply calling out the military or declaring martial law or something, because you've built up to that. And it can, you know, it actually goes to sort of theories about, you know, crime, which is you do not allow small crimes to occur, because eventually people get used to it, and then they don't, you know, you get the likelihood of much bigger crimes occurring.
You know, one more question along these lines, Eli, I wanted to ask, is it one thing, you know, it's one thing to say it could happen, but another thing for altogether for it to actually happen, what in your view would be the precipitating event? Because to me, you know, as I look at this, it's the 2024 presidential election. And if some states refuse to certify the winner of the election in a particular state.
I think 2024 is a big deal. I mean, 2022 matters in terms of policy in Washington. But 2024 is the next moment that we have where we are testing this presidential election system again. And the Pennsylvania governor's race, by the way, the Arizona governor's race, play into this in a big way with some of the candidates that Republicans have elevated who are they're election deniers with regard to 2020. And so I think those two contests are going to weigh pretty heavily on how we think about 2024.
Bob, you were chiming in there. You think 2024 is a big deal too.
Yeah, exactly. And what's fascinating to that point is the possibility of people getting elected to office under, ironically, the very systems they claim don't work. And then if an election goes the wrong way, they might have the power simply to say, we're nullifying this election.
Yeah.
And so I think it's very possible,
Okay, Eli, let's turn to this concern about candidates refusing to take part in debates, refusing to sit down for interviews with journalists, for that matter. How big of a problem is that these days in Eli Yokley's world?
I think the debates, we're seeing that in a big way this year. There's a lot of candidates who are not participating in any debates. There's some that are only doing a couple debates. I think that's something that weighs on the way we've always thought about covering political campaigns. I remember whenever you and I were covering the Senate race in Missouri in 2012, those debates were huge moments in the campaign. That's not how it is anymore, to some extent. I mean, so much of what's happening in campaigns today is all about what you can get on television with your own money. Nobody interceding with it. And making your case directly to voters without having to worry about getting pushed back by the press or by a candidate. Whether or not that's good for democracy is that's another question, but that's the world we're living in today for sure.
Bob, is that good for democracy if the campaigns become, as Eli points out, all about what's on TV?
Well, Eli's 100% correct that it's been changing, and I think it is good for democracy to have debates and have the candidates available. And then it's up to the voters. If they don't want to watch, they don't have to watch, but it's there for them. The problem, Steve, is that what I've just said, if the voters don't want to watch, is that then there's not as big as an incentive for, to be honest, network television to broadcast them. And so we have this odd dynamic where we put debates often in charge, the people in charge of them are running television stations. I'm not blasting them. And that's probably not who should be in charge. So a few states have had debate commissions. Ohio has one, and they're having debates where it's like the presidential debates, but Trump maybe has blown that one up a bit, in which it's out of the hands of, basically, to be honest, capitalist type entities that have to worry about profits, and it's in nonpartisan commissions to at least have one or two in a given state.
But even at the state level, Eli, for journalists, for some good government groups, we talk about debates as being a really big deal. It's sort of the least that candidates can do is to take part in these things. But do people watch them? Do they have much impact anymore?
I mean, what's like the last big moment you remember from a US Senate debate? I mean, the issue is the problem for campaigns is like the risk assessment here. I mean, the biggest moment you're going to have is a major screw up on this stage. The best night you can have is that nobody cares about what you said. And so there's not really an incentive structure for these campaigns to engage in this level. I mean, the danger just kind of outweighs the problem. There was the Kelly Ayotte moment where she said that Trump would be a role model for her kids around the same time as the Access Hollywood tape. There was the Indiana Senate candidate in 2012 who leaned into some of the same talk as Todd Akin. I mean, whenever we're talking about these like politically disastrous moments emerging from these stages, we're really not talking about great moments where candidates shine that change the course of elections on their behalf.
But Bob, if we're sitting here talking about the pure political calculation that goes into whether to debate or not, is it naive to suggest that maybe there should be a greater reason to do these things than just the political calculation here? Or am I just whistling Dixie here?
Yeah, John McCain from Arizona, I would call him the late great John McCain. He said he always debated his opponent because it was the right thing to do, and I believed him. That's rare. In Kansas, I've had, oh my goodness, and I'm not here to complain, but Steve, I've spent hundreds of hours on a debate. This is a true story, and had in Kansas, and then the morning of the debate, the Senate candidate just called and said, "No, I'm not going to do it." We had the studio, we had the other opponents, and it's like I was so mad. It was Pat Roberts. I'll tell you exactly who it was. However, to Eli's point, when he was in a tough race with Greg Orman, there he was in the debate. So yes, it's naive to think the candidates will do it because, oh, it's the right thing to do. That means that the candidate shouldn't be deciding. Now, one of the really bad trends, I would argue, in Kansas is now even primary debates are in the are not happening really, because in Kansas, the Republican Party, which has the most interesting primaries, now says we're going to run the primary debates, and they're even basically shutting out candidates, and now they're not on television, et cetera, so we don't even really have primary debates in Kansas.
Well, speaking of all this, Eli, in Missouri, are there any debates scheduled for the open U.S. Senate seat that Roy Blunt is vacating? The Republican in the race is Eric Schmidt. The Democrat is Trudy Bush Valentine.
I don't think so yet. I don't think so
They're
yet.
still arguing about it, right?
They're arguing about it a lot. I mean, this is one of those things you guys were talking about earlier. Like, a number of TV stations that want to host these still, because I do think that the television networks want to do good things for democracy during an election year, and they can sell ads and try to pump these up. It's great for their anchors. They can make their anchors a star on these debate stages, maybe, if something happens. But there's just no incentive. I mean, if I'm Eric Schmidt, why would I actually want to sit down with Trudy Bush Valentine tomorrow and have a debate?
Because he's so far ahead in the polls, you're saying.
Because he's winning a lot. He's going to win this thing by maybe double digits, maybe not. But like, there's just no political incentive here for candidates, especially in these contests where they're far ahead, to engage. I mean, the reason candidates want to do this is so they can tout weaknesses of their rivals.
Right.
That's why you're seeing Dr. Oz in Pennsylvania try to push John Fetterman to do several debates, do them for 90 minutes instead of an hour, because the guy had a stroke and has a hard time talking right now, and he wants to put that on television. Right. It's the same thing in Georgia with Raphael Warnock pushing for Herschel Walker to be on multiple debate stages. Right. He doesn't think Herschel Walker can make a coherent point in a debate. They want to flex their rivals' weaknesses on stage.
We're talking about the state of American democracy being in trouble and the lack of debates being one contributing factor to all this. Let's go to some phone calls. Skip from Kansas City North, you're on Up to Date, Skip.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Well, thanks for calling,
you know,
Skip.
I draw some parallels from the 30s, and it appears that the parallel between the rise of the Nazis and the Republican Party is actually taking place in this country today.
Bob, you want to weigh in on that?
Well, I teach a comparative politics class, and we talk about tyranny and how it arises. And again, it's very simple. You break down institutions, and one of the key ones is the media. And that's just that's tyranny 101, by the way. But you break down other institutions, and the one that we're seeing lately is the election system. And so, yeah, it certainly has happened in the past.
Steve from Lawrence, is democracy in danger, Steve?
Indeed it is, and I'd agree with Skip. There are some parallels with Nazi Germany. Certainly the Fuhrer principle that was in play then has become a principle of many Republicans. I wanted to comment on President Biden calling out MAGA Republicans. I'm an independent. I totally agree with that. And my comment was that I'm a Christian, and there's a Christian church, so-called, in Topeka that pickets funerals of military men and says mean things about gay people. When people talk about that group and say, hey, that group is extremist, they do not represent the majority of Christians, I appreciate it. And yet I feel like President Biden, when he called out the MAGA Republicans and left room for normal Republicans, I think he got a lot of criticism for that. And I'd be interested what your guests have to say about that. I'll take my comments off the air.
Thank you, Steve. Eli, what do you think?
I mean, the challenge for separating the two parts of the Republican Party, they exist. They for sure exist. But when you ask people if Donald Trump should play a major role in the Republican Party or not, that would be the MAGA Republicans in this case, like 57% of Republicans say he should play a major role, even more say he should play a minor role. When you test the hypothetical 2024 primary, you get Donald Trump at higher level of support than even Joe Biden had in his campaign. And so this is the bulk of the Republican Party. You're seeing it play out in all these campaigns, by the way, and that's one of the challenges the party's dealing with this year is a lot of these MAGA-like candidates have been elevated in a number of key Senate races. And Democrats spent a lot of money using the Claire McCaskill strategy that we know so well and elevating them in House races. And so Democrats are betting a lot that voters are ready to reject MAGA Republicans, as they call them, this year. It's going to be a hard bet, though, especially with the House as competitive for Republicans as it is.
You know, in Kansas, Bob, we asked Eli about what's happening in Missouri, the lack of debates in the U.S. Senate race there. But we just had on the Kansas side a gubernatorial debate at the state fair between the two candidates for governor, Democrat Laura Kelly, Republican Derek Schmidt. Can we expect a debate on this side of the state, or where do we stand there?
Well, let me first say that was the first state fair debate I've attended, and oh my gosh, it was absolutely fantastic.
They're
it
fun,
was
aren't
wonderful.
They? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It was wonderful. But it was a great debate. They talked about a lot of issues and, you know, and really went back and forth. It was a fantastic debate, and it should have been on one of the networks, you know, a month later, so everybody could see it at 7 p.m. at night. It wasn't. But to your question, there's one more debate, which will be in Overland Park on October 5th and will be broadcast by Kansas City Public Television.
There you go. Well, I want to thank our guests for running down the state of democracy as it pertains to debates and candidates making themselves accessible to journalists. That's Bob Beatty. He's a political scientist at Washburn University. Eli Yokley, a senior reporter at Morning Consult, covering politics and campaigns. Gentlemen, always appreciate your time. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Steve.
Thanks, Steve.
This is Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. I'm Steve Kraske. KCUR and Up to Date are participating in the nationwide cooperative Democracy Day 2022, a project of Montclair State University. The question is America's democracy in danger and what's threatening it? Tweet us at KCUR Up to Date with hashtag Democracy Day. Now, a look at redistricting as we look at yet another aspect of the state of our government on this International Day of Democracy. Every state in the country, including Kansas and Missouri, just went through this process, which remains one of the most arcane and mysterious in our politics. Critics of redistricting suggest that it results in the dominant party holding too much power. For instance, in Missouri, 6 of the 8 members of Congress are Republican, in a state that many believe is more closely divided than that. So what can be done? What needs to happen? Here to talk about it, Peverell Squires, a professor of political science at the University of Missouri, where he holds the Hicks and Martha Griffiths Chair in American Political Institutions. Professor, always good to have you on the show. Welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
Kansas State Representative Stephanie Clayton is a Democrat from Overland Park. She's in the House with me here. Last year, she participated in the legislature's series of town halls to get public input on how redistricting should be conducted. Representative Clayton, good to have you as well.
Great to be here, Steve.
So, Representative, we're having this conversation in the wake of this recent poll that I mentioned in the opening that suggested that about 2/3 of Americans surveyed said democracy is in danger. What are you seeing among your own constituents these days? What are they thinking?
Well, I think a lot of my constituents are concerned as well, in particular regarding congressional redistricting and the way that the redistricting process took place in Kansas. So Kansas is one of the states where the legislature draws our own lines. And so it's one thing to have the state legislature drawing congressional lines, but it's also highly concerning that we also draw our own lines. And so a lot of this happened with our congressional redistricting maps. They put those up first and they put our maps up last, right? And so that sort of held a lot of us hostage, right? You have a lot of people who were sort of afraid to fight too hard because of the, oh, I would call it the I'll give you something to cry about scenario that could potentially happen.
Meaning that if you object to the way certain districts are drawn at the congressional level, that could come back to haunt you in terms of the way your own district is drawn.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And is it your feeling that the state legislature shouldn't be drawing these lines, that it's a job for maybe an independent commission to do something like that?
Literally anyone except for the legislators should be drawing our own lines. It's not an issue for us to draw congressional lines or even school board lines, right? But senators shouldn't be drawing their own lines. Representatives shouldn't be drawing their own lines because we have a stake in this, right? And so, you know, power corrupts, and I don't think that we should be in charge of our, at least our legislative lines.
Professor Squire, I'm wondering what your own view is on the state of our democracy these days. How do you see things? Will we be celebrating Democracy Day 2023?
I assume we will, although it's going to be a rough go between now and then. I'm certainly redistricting is of great concern to a number of people around the country. And as the representative noted, each state does it a little bit differently. And here in Missouri, of course, the state legislature draws the congressional district lines, but the state legislative lines are drawn by independent commissions, and that process went remarkably well on the House side this time and not so well on the state Senate side. And of course, then we had big hangups over the U.S. House district lines being drawn in the state legislature. So In lots of different ways, we can see across the country. Some states do it more successfully than others.
You know, let's turn and talk more about redistricting here. Representative Clayton, you went to the redistricting town hall state tour with fellow lawmakers just last year. What do you recall from the public? What was it wanting to see in the way the state was divided up when it came to congressional lines and, for that matter, state legislative lines?
Overwhelmingly, what we heard from the public, regardless of what portion of the state we were in, was a desire to have the Kansas City area together. And, of course, as we saw from those maps, the exact opposite of the testimony happened. So it seemed, almost a farce, right? You know, we're going to sit here. Oh, yeah, we'll take this input. But the map to divide Wyandotte and Johnson, or to divide the Kansas City area, was very clear all along.
Hmm. And also, you heard a lot of talk from those town halls that people wanted a nonpartisan process. At least that's what I read in the news accounts at the time.
Yes, that was also very clear. And, you know, part of the thing is that partisan redistricting shouldn't be happening. This should be a very generic, very removed from politics process.
But you can't take the politics out of it. It's simply impossible.
It's very difficult to do so, yes. But we can depoliticize it as much as possible.
By doing what?
By honestly having it being a independent commission of lay people.
How much interest is there in setting up an independent commission to do it the way you're suggesting?
Almost zero. I think we have had introduced bills several times. We would have to change the Kansas Constitution in order to do this, but that requires a 2/3 majority in both the House and the Senate. Then it would go to a vote of the people. Those bills did not even get a hearing.
But it's certainly not a radical idea, because other states, including one right to our north, Iowa, does it that way.
Yes, of course. And so other states have done this, but for whatever reason, Kansas is not even considering having hearings on this.
Well, the Republicans control the state house, obviously, in Kansas. What did they want to get out of this redistricting process?
Power.
Mm-hmm. Meaning?
Meaning control of the legislature and of the congressional seats. And so that's part of the problem. If, you know, right now they currently have power, and logically you can't expect them to even give that up. Now, obviously they should. This should be a depoliticized experience. This should belong to the people, not to the legislators.
I'm wondering what happened to your own district in Overland Park. You may have been a target for Republicans because you, in a very well publicized move, switch parties a few years ago. What happened to your district?
My district actually remained remarkably the same. It actually got a little bit bluer at the expense of more vulnerable legislators around me. So that's a terrible position to be in, to be honest.
You know, one example of how things have changed is incumbent Congresswoman Charisse Davids in the state's 3rd district that used to cover Johnson and Wyandotte counties. She now has to run in a district that skews far more Republican than it has in the past. What happened there?
What happened there was that they were trying to essentially disenfranchise the Kansas City area. So Johnson and Wyandotte County, in particular the areas inside the 435 loop, have always been part of the Kansas City area. We're more Kansas City than Kansas. And so by disenfranchising Wyandotte County, by drawing it into a more rural area, and by diluting Johnson County, by putting it in with other counties that know nothing about Johnson County or the Kansas City area, you've really kind of cut that area in two. And I find that particularly frustrating given the fact that the Kansas City area is where most of the population of Kansas resides. And so that was a very personal strike against both Johnson and Wyandotte County.
But the argument was the county, the populations had grown so much that you simply had to divide it up because there was no other way to draw the maps without doing that.
There were plenty of other ways to draw maps without doing that. One of the maps that I brought up as an amendment kept Johnson County whole and had the part of Wyandotte County that has the Kansas City area inside the 3rd congressional district. So the population center, the Kansas City area, was kept whole. That option was there, and it was not taken.
But instead, we got a redrawn map that puts how much of Wyandotte County in the 2nd district of the state?
The portion that's north of I-70 into the 2nd district. And it is completely counterintuitive and, frankly, not only disenfranchises economic areas of interest, but also racial areas of interest.
Well, let's turn to Missouri here, Professor Mr. Squire. Missouri very much in a similar situation with a Republican-controlled legislature. How drastic a change did they want to see in state legislative districts and in congressional districts for that matter?
I think in terms of the state legislative districts, again, on the state House side, the commission came to an agreement, which I think surprised most of us. We won't see any dramatic shifts. There are a few changes in my local district that perhaps make it a little more Democratic than the previous version of it was. But for the most part, the state legislative districts have not changed radically. The big focus on the big debate and the big battle was over the congressional districts. And that was really within the Republican Party. You had a group of very conservative Republican state senators who wanted to try to split up the Kansas City, Missouri side of the debate and to try to make it easier for Republicans to perhaps pick up seven seats instead of the six they currently hold. They failed in that, but they still managed to draw district lines that took the one competitive seat that we really have in the state, which is just outside St. Louis, and try to make it slightly less competitive, that is a little safer for the Republican incumbent.
And they did that, right?
It appears they did that, but well, you know, this is such a curious year, and with the abortion decision coming down, it may have shuffled the deck a little bit. But certainly that was the intent, and there's a good chance that it will succeed.
So bottom line here, Professor, which voices get amplified, which get diminished because of the way these districts have been drawn?
The way the districts are drawn in Missouri, the congressional districts, and to some extent also the state legislative districts, is the voices that get amplified tend to be at the extremes of the two parties, more Republican districts than Democratic districts. But a lot of the competition will be in the primary elections and not in the general election. And in the primary election, there's always the tendency for, on the Republican side, the more conservative voices to dominate. And on the Democratic side, perhaps the more liberal voices to dominate. So it will sort of perpetuate or at least exaggerate the polarization that we see in Missouri. And as it plays out in a lot of other states, across the nation as well.
And the argument, Professor, is that Democratic voices wind up getting overwhelmed here because with only two of the eight seats being Democratic, just a quarter of the seats, Democrats lose a voice.
They do. You could draw districts here in Missouri that would make probably a 5 Republican to 3 Democratic split likely. Of course, the Republicans were never going to agree to that. I think the big loss is really in making that second district less competitive. The other districts here in the state of Missouri are predominantly biased in favor of one of the other parties. And so here for the state of Missouri, the congressional races will be pretty much ignored because they're simply too little competition for anybody to care about.
Which voices in Kansas, Representative Clayton, wind up getting amplified? Which ones get diminished as a result of the way districts are drawn at both the congressional and state house level?
By far, the rural voices get amplified and the urban and suburban voices get silenced. And ironically, that is where the population centers are in urban and suburban areas. And to be perfectly frank, that's where most of the tax money that runs the state is generated from. So it's very much taking our money and removing our voices. I find it so incredibly wrong.
And the impact on democracy is what?
It's not good. It's terrible, in fact. When I saw our congressional map that is now law, the first thing that I did was I started laughing because I thought, surely it can't be this bad. And it was this bad, and I'm not laughing anymore.
I want to thank our two guests here talking about the impact of redistricting on our democracy. That was the voice of Kansas State Representative Stephanie Clayton. She's a Democrat from Overland Park. We are also joined by Peverell Squire, a professor of political science at the University of Missouri. Thank you both very much. Much appreciated.
Thank you, Steve.
My pleasure.
This is Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. I'm Steve Kraske. Today, KCUR and Up to Date are participating in the nationwide Cooperative Democracy Day 2022, a project of the Center for Cooperative Media at Montclair State University. One intensely controversial area of the law in recent years is what state legislatures across the country and in Topeka and Jeff City are doing when it comes to limiting voter access to the polls. In Missouri, for instance, the League of Women Voters and the Missouri NAACP are suing the state over a new election law that restricts voter registration activities and the distribution of absentee ballots. Residents in the state will now have to show an approved identification card to cast a regular ballot. In Kansas, new laws in the state also place a chilling effect on the ability to register new voters. What's going on? Why all the new laws when many experts contend that there's little to no voter fraud in our elections to begin with? Here to talk about it, Janet Milkovich is president of the Johnson County League of Women Voters. Janet, nice to have you. Welcome.
Good morning.
Greg Benami is an associate professor and chair of the UMKC Political Science Department. Greg, always good to have you. Welcome back.
Good morning.
Well, Greg, give us an overview here. Why are both our states passing new laws that place these new restrictions on voter registration efforts?
So there's a couple explanations for why these laws pass. If you look at photo identification requirements, so you mentioned that how controversial they've been. While they're controversial, if you look at surveys among voters, they're popular among both Republican and Democratic voters. Mm. There's majority support among Republican and Democratic voters for general photo ID requirements. Apart from public opinion, there's also a perceived partisan advantage. So Republicans often perceive photo ID laws as helping them. If you look at the demographic profile of non-voters and marginal voters, they look more like Democratic voters, even though they're not more likely to vote Democratic.
Right.
And Democrats likewise perceive a disadvantage to these laws. So you bring in these competing partisan forces to either advocate for or push against these laws because of this perceived partisan advantage.
You know, Professor, how concerned should voters be that unproven claims of election fraud winds up being the driving force behind at least some of these new initiatives?
If you look at study, and that's one of the questions, you know, so it's like there's not very much voter fraud out there to prevent, especially voter impersonation, which is what, if photo ID laws do anything, it should be prevent voter impersonation, which is a negligible problem. There's also a question of maybe these laws help with perceived election fraud, right? So maybe there's no actual fraud, but maybe people believe there is. So having these laws is useful because it makes people think the election is
clean. And it makes people feel better about the system.
Possibly. But studies actually show that doesn't happen either. States that have photo ID requirements don't show any increase in election confidence or perceived rates of election fraud or cleanliness.
But Janet, you wonder, is there an impact then on access when it comes to some voters being denied access to the polls? Kansas saw record turnout in the August primary, probably because of that abortion amendment that was on the ballot. Still, it did show that if people actually want to vote, they can do so.
Yes. You know, you would think in America and in Kansas, we would want everybody to exercise the right to vote. That's a privilege that we have. So many other countries don't extend that privilege to people. So I always ask the question, why would any legislator want to minimize the number of people that can vote? And what would be the disadvantage of registering people to vote so that they can exercise that privilege?
Yeah. Do you feel that access is being denied in Kansas as a result of these new laws?
Absolutely.
And what proof do you have?
Well, I have proof from the League of Women Voters, what we personally experienced, so anecdotal proof. But the League of Women Voters in Kansas, we usually register about 5,000 people a year to get to the polls. When the voter suppression bills were passed in the legislature in the 21-22 session, we are prevented from registering voters. So we know that for 2 years, the work that the League has done since for the last 102 years was stopped at ground to a halt. So fewer people are 18-year-olds, people in nursing homes, people that had relocated, people with disabilities, all across the board. They did not have opportunities to register, or the opportunities to register became cumbersome.
And just quickly, explain how the new law prevents the League from helping to register new voters, Janet.
Okay. Well, there are two House bills, and one is 2183 and one is 2332. And they state that If we, anybody who registers voters, that's could be guilty of committing a felony crime, and that would be punishable by jail time and also a fine.
And that would have a chilling effect on anyone, any member of the League wanting to help out here.
Right. League and other voter rights groups. So the League of Women Voters of Johnson County, along with other voter rights groups, has sued the legislature to get that revoked.
Greg, we had Missouri Secretary of State Jay Ashcroft on this program recently promising that every registered voter can cast a ballot and that their vote will count come election time. But if people are hearing they must have a photo ID to vote, you know, how real is the danger that some voters aren't going to show up as a result?
So there's a couple of pieces there. So one is sort of picking up on this idea of what groups can do anytime you change election procedures, like adding a photo ID requirement. There's also a communication part to that. So the law simultaneously adds the requirement while also limiting some of the activity that groups can do in order to communicate those changes to voters. The other piece is, so Missouri's law not only added a photo ID requirement, they also added in-person early voting or in-person absentee voting. So there's a two-week period. That's no excuse required. So they did expand
some
access.
That's a change.
That's a change, right? So that's a new change for Missouri, at least at the state level. The other thing that they did is it's a somewhat permissive photo ID requirement in that if somebody shows up and they don't have a photo ID, my guess is probably the biggest limitation there is people with an expired driver's license who didn't realize it until election day, expired driver's licenses don't count. They're allowed to cast a provisional ballot. And if they cast a provisional ballot, it then goes to election officials for a signature match. So even if somebody doesn't have a requisite photo ID, there's sort of a backstop. As long as there's a signature match on file, that vote will still count.
That's what Jay Ashcroft's message was if you don't have the right ID, go vote. Your vote can still count, most likely.
That's right. Now, there may be some variation from place to place, so that's going to be up to local election officials. So we're not sure what they're going to do for signature matches, how stringent they're going to be based on that criteria, how many ballots they're going to reject. But certainly, I think that message is the right one. If somebody shows up and they don't have their photo ID, do cast a provisional ballot.
Janet, as you know as well as anyone, Johnson County Sheriff Kelvin Hayden has spent months conducting a criminal investigation into elections, which doesn't appear to have gotten very far, the investigation. The League has come out very strongly against what the sheriff is doing, calling the whole thing a sham election investigation. Why? Why is the League calling it that way?
Well, because there are accusations appear to be baseless. You know, when it boils down to it, I think there's one charge that he has revealed. But mainly, you know, the sheriff, as a League, we can't really talk about candidates. But we do know that election practices, if an elected official, like a sheriff or somebody, says their department should be escorting all ballots from the ballot boxes, you know, the what's the word I'm thinking about?
They want to have a sheriff's deputy right there to be with the ballots every step of the way to when they're being counted.
Right, yeah. Exactly. Mm-hmm. So, and the other thing, any elected official should be, I'm sorry, I'm drawing a blank on that question.
Yeah. But your point is that you have real problems with what Sheriff Hayden's doing.
Yes, and you know, I think you referenced the August election and the great voter turnout.
Right.
Part of that is that we, the League, and other organizations made people aware of what was on the ballot.
Mm-hmm.
Many people that we met with didn't know that a suggested constitutional amendment was going to be on the primary ballot. Others didn't know that if you weren't a Republican or Democrat, but you were unaffiliated, that they could vote. That's the same thing we want to do for the November. There are two constitutional amendments, one being about the sheriff, the other being about a possible shift from the executive branch to the legislative branch.
Well, Professor Vanami, when a sheriff even takes on an investigation like this, does it have an impact on how some voters wind up viewing the election system?
Potentially, and that's a risk. And it would be unfortunate if anyone sat out the election or declined to participate because they thought there was fraud based on these statements that have been made.
Yeah. You know, Janet, the new voter laws have simply curtailed how involved the League can be in voter registration efforts on the Kansas side. Exactly, what's affected and what can you do going forward?
Well, what we found a workaround that we believe is legal, and we pass out cards that have QR codes, and people can use their own device, whether it's an Apple phone, their iPad, and they can access all the voter information they need on these QR codes, and then they can register themselves. So we can stand near them. We can advise them of what's going on. We can show them how to use the device, and then they can register themselves. So we're still out in the community everywhere reminding people of the privilege of voting, the importance of voting, the deadlines for registering the vote, when early vote begins.
But being very careful in the process
we
to
have
abide
to be very,
by this new law.
Very careful.
Yeah. You know, Greg, am I missing something here? But what I'm not seeing are lawmakers from either of our two states passing laws that make voting easier. You did point out the two-week window in Missouri. That's a step forward. But am I missing something there?
So if you compare the states to other states, they're in terms of convenience voting. Kansas is doing a pretty good job. I mean, they're pretty on par with what most other states are doing. Missouri's a little bit of an outlier in terms of the way they handle mail-in ballots. So they still have a pretty restrictive system of excuse required absentee ballots. 35 states have no excuse absentee voting or vote by mail. So Missouri is a bit of an outlier there in having a more restrictive process.
And this push for more advanced voting availability, this took a long time. That's been talked about and kicked around for years in this state.
It took a long time, and that's probably the direction. So what we've seen nationwide is increasingly fewer voters are voting on Election Day. So in 2016, about a third of the electorate had already voted by the time Election Day came around. And that more than doubled in 2020. That was obviously the pandemic. But every year, it's about a 3% additional increase of voters preferring an alternative convenience mode of voting.
Right, interesting. We'll have to leave our conversation there. And it was a good one. I want to thank Greg Vannami again, an associate professor and chair of the UMKC Political Science Department. Janet Milkovich, president of the Johnson County League of Women Voters. Thanks for the updates. Much appreciated. Up to Date is a production of KCUR 89.3. Our theme music was composed by the great Bobby Watson. The program is produced by Danny Alexander, Zach Wilson, Elizabeth Ruiz, and Reginald David. Our engineer is Paul Nakatura. I'm Steve Kraske. Thanks for listening.